This is Carrie from Eugene, Oregon, and you are listening to California Dreaming on the Orbital Jigsaw Network.
This episode of California Dreaming is brought to you by Blueberry. Creating a podcast is not that simple. It's more than just recording yourself and uploading it. To really get your show to be everything you want it to be, you're going to need a little more than that. You need easy and reliable hosting so your time can be spent creating your content, the most accurate download stats so you know if you are reaching the audience that you're wanting, and a web page that makes setting up totally easy on you and won't take up too much of your valuable time. And Blueberry offers all of this and more for hosts and aspiring hosts alike. Simple media hosting, a fully integrated WordPress website with their PowerPress sites. So if you already have a podcast, or you've always dreamed about starting one, head over to www.orbitaljigsaw.com/dream to sign up, and the first month is on me. The Blueberry support team is always available to walk you through the steps of migrating your show without losing any subscribers, or to help you get started in the process of launching your new show. With the first month for free using promo code DREAM, you've got no excuses. So, let's get started. Dreamers, you know, every once in a while, someone notable, a celebrity, a singer, an actor, perhaps an athlete, passes away suddenly and unexpectedly. We've talked about some of them over the past year. We talked about Phil Hartman in episode 3, Dana Plato in episode 11, River Phoenix in our Halloween bonus last year, Lana Clarkson in episode 35, Brandon Lee, which was first on Patreon, but it can be found in the regular feed from March of this year. Also on Patreon, we discussed the murder of Rebecca Schaefer, as well as Washington Redskins safety Sean Taylor. But the ones that seem to just come out of nowhere, out of the blue, for example, like Dana Plato, had a relatively well-documented history of struggles with addiction. So when she passed away of a drug overdose, it was indeed tragic, but might not otherwise have been as much of a shock as, say, the death of Brandon Lee was, who died in a completely freak accident. Those can sometimes resonate differently with us. We feel the sense of loss when someone passes away, just as they were on the brink of seeing their careers reach new heights. Brandon Lee is a perfect example of this. The Crow was going to be his breakout role, and he didn't get the chance to ever see it happen. Another one that comes to my mind right away is Aaliyah, who on August 25th, 2001 died along with 8 others in a plane crash in the Bahamas after filming a music video. Not only was the pilot not licensed to fly at the time of the accident, and toxicology reports revealed that he had cocaine in his system, it was also later determined after an extensive investigation that the plane was 700 pounds or 320 kilograms over its maximum takeoff weight. In addition, it was carrying one more passenger than it was licensed to be carrying. According to the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, the plane was observed lifting off the runway and then went nose down, crashing into a marsh on the south side of the departure end of the runway. It was also found that the pilot, Luis Morales, obtained his FAA license by falsifying hundreds of hours that he never actually flew. And he also falsified the number of hours he had flown in order to get the job with the company Aaliyah was flying with, Blackhawk International Airways. Another singer many of you may be familiar with, I'm sure, who was also on the brink of breaking into mainstream music here in the United States, was one of the most influential Tejano music singers of her time, Selena. She was gunned down by the president of her fan club, Yolanda Saldivar, on March 31st, 1995, over a dispute over missing money from the fan club treasury. Selena and her family began receiving phone calls from fans who said that they had sent money into the fan club but did not receive the gifts that they were promised for joining. When Selena's brother began to look into the matter, he soon discovered that Saldivar had embezzled approximately $30,000 not only from the fan club, but from Selena's clothing boutiques as well. He spoke to Selena and her sister Suzette, and he wanted the three of them to go confront Saldivar about the missing money, which they did. They gave her the chance to disprove their findings and to sort out where the missing money was, otherwise they said that they would file a police report. Though he wanted Saldivar to stay away from Selena, Selena didn't immediately cut ties with her friend, as she felt as though Saldivar was an important part of the success of her clothing line in Mexico. She also knew that Saldivar had all of the financial records that they needed in order to prepare their tax returns, so she didn't want to jeopardize that. But Saldivar continued to stall, coming up with the bank statements and records to dispute the missing funds, insisting that it was a misunderstanding. She even went so far to say that she had been physically and sexually assaulted in Mexico. Feeling sympathetic towards Saldivar, Selena went with her to a clinic on March 31, 1995, supposedly to have Saldivar examined for the sexual assault. She was given a brief physical examination by the clinic's doctor, but it did not include a gynecological exam, usually given for sexual assault cases, so she was referred to another clinic. Following that visit to the clinic, Selena met up with Saldivar at her hotel room at the Days Inn in Corpus Christi, Texas, and this is when Selena asked to see the financial papers that she had been promised. And just before noon, Saldivar retrieved a gun from her purse and pointed it towards Selena. As she attempted to run out the door, Saldivar shot her once in the right lower shoulder, which severed a major artery, causing Selena massive blood loss. But Selena continued to run, leaving behind a 392-foot-long or 119-meter-long trail of blood. Selena collapsed on the floor of the lobby as the clerk was calling 911. Saldivar had attempted to chase Selena down, calling her a bitch in doing so. Selena was able to tell the clerk in the lobby that it was Saldivar who shot her and told her what room it happened in. Saldivar attempted to flee in her truck, but she was stopped by an officer responding to the emergency call. She remained in a standoff with the police, holding the gun to her head for more than 9 hours before surrendering. She would go on to be convicted and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole until 2025. And last year, there was a rumor that circulated that Saldivar was found dead in her prison cell, but Texas officials came forward shortly after and confirmed that she is still alive. Another sudden passing was the November 30th, 2013 death of Paul Walker. At about 3:30 that afternoon, Paul, along with his friend Roger Rodas, had departed from a charity event organized by Paul, the Reach Out Worldwide for the Victims of Typhoon Yolanda. It was a charity that he founded in the wake of the 2010 Haitian earthquake. Roger was behind the wheel of his Porsche Carrera GT. While driving along in an area that posted a 45-mile-an-hour or 72-kilometer-per-hour speed limit on Hercules Street and Kelly Johnson Parkway in Valencia, California, Roger crashed the car into a concrete lamppost and two trees. The vehicle burst into flames immediately, and part of the inferno was captured on cell phone video from bystanders shortly after the crash occurred. Both men died instantly inside the burning vehicle, Rodas having died of multiple traumatic injuries, and Paul having died of a combination of traumatic injuries and burns. Both of them were burned beyond recognition. Paul was 48 years old, and Roger was 38. So today, I'm going to tell you the story of another young man whose life was tragically cut short, suddenly and unexpectedly, just as he was on the cusp of making a name for himself in the world of Major League Baseball. He, along with three of his friends who were out celebrating a milestone in their friend's fledgling baseball career. In today's bonus episode of California Dreaming, the tale of Nick Aidenhart, Courtney Stewart, Henry Pearson, and John Wilhite. Nicholas James Aidenhart, Nick is what we will call him for this story, was born the only son of Janet and Jim Aidenhart on August 24th, 1986, in Silver Spring, Maryland. His parents would go on to divorce, and his mother would remarry, and Nick would have a half-brother, Henry. Nick began playing baseball at a young age, taking up the position of pitcher in his local pony league. He was a member of the 1999 team that won the Maryland District 1 title. He attended St. Maria Goretti High School in Hagerstown, Maryland. In addition to pitching, he also played the positions of shortstop and outfield. And that wasn't the only sport he played, as when baseball season ended, he found himself as a guard on the school's basketball team as well. So now, for the next several minutes, we are going to go through the timeline of Nick's baseball career. And it can get kind of repetitive, maybe even boring if you're not that much into baseball. But if you stay tuned in, it will give you a good idea of how much Nick had to go through to finally get where he wanted to be in his career, as he went through many ups and downs along the way. So bear with me if you can. When Nick was 14, he joined the Oriolanders, a team composed of Maryland amateur players that were sponsored by the Baltimore Orioles, and he would play with them for 4 years. When he was 16, Nick pitched for the Yauces Maryland Orioles, and they would go on to win the All-American Amateur Baseball Association tournament for that year. He ended up transferring to Williamsport High School after 10th grade and gave up basketball to keep his focus on baseball and his pitching. And this is about the time that scouts began keeping their eyes on this young prospect. With a record of 6-0 and a 1.04 earned run average during his junior year season on the team, he was named Gatorade Player of the Year in Maryland. He would go on to throw a no-hitter with 14 strikeouts in the quarterfinal playoffs that year. In his last year in high school, Nick was considered the top high school prospect in the country. That year, he threw a perfect game in his very first time on the mound, striking out 15 of the 21 batters he faced. And at the end of his final regular season in high school, he had a record of 5-1 with a 0.73 earned run average and an average of 2.2 strikeouts per inning. By November of his senior year, he had signed a letter of intent to play baseball at the University of North Carolina. However, in his very last game in high school, with as many as 24 scouts looking on, Nick felt a pop in his elbow after throwing a curveball to the third batter that was up. The injury was a ligament tear requiring surgery, abruptly ending his season. He graduated high school in 2004, and when he had once been projected to be chosen in the first round draft pick in that year's Major League Baseball draft, the injury caused his stock to plummet. He ended up falling to 413th overall in the 14th round, chosen by the Anaheim Angels. Dan Radcliffe, the Angels organization scout, and Eddie Bain, the director of scouting, convinced Nick to forego the scholarship from the University of North Carolina and signed him to a $710,000 bonus on July 26, 2004, which he accepted. He had the surgery completed on his elbow and spent the next year in the Angels rehab facility located in Tempe, Arizona. While there, he attended classes at Arizona State University. Nick debuted as a professional on June 25, 2005 with the Pioneer League's Orem Owls, which is the Angels' rookie league. In his one and only appearance for the Owls, Nick pitched 6 innings, allowing 1 unearned run, struck out 7 batters, and won the game. He spent the remainder of the 2005 season playing with the Angels of the Arizona League. In 13 games, he had a 2-3 record, a 3.68 earned run average, and 52 strikeouts. The following spring, at the age of 19, Nick was one of 12 pitchers who earned a non-roster invitation to the Angels' big league camp. As the 2006 baseball season was about to begin, he was ranked the 6th best prospect on the Angels and 90th overall in the league. He ended up being assigned to the Cedar Rapids Colonels, also an Angels affiliate, following spring training, and he did very well for the team. In 16 games, he had 10 wins and a 1.95 earned run average and 99 strikeouts in 106 innings. This earned him a spot on the All-Stars Futures games that year, and then he was bumped up to the Rancho Cucamonga Quakes, another higher-ranking Angels affiliate. And he continued to play well for the Quakes, and soon he became a member of the United States Olympic qualifying team in 2006. By 2007, Nick was a top-ranking prospect in the Angels organization. But for the 2007 season, he played for the AA Arkansas Travelers. In 26 games with them, he had a record of 10-8 with a 3.65 earned run average. The next year, he played for the AAA Salt Lake Bees and played for them for part of the 2008 season. After that, he was finally brought up to the Angels roster, scheduled to make his debut on May 1st, 2008. Against the Oakland A's, Nick finally made his major league debut at home in Angel Stadium. At the time, Nick was the youngest active pitcher in the major leagues. Unfortunately, in his debut, he gave up 5 earned runs, walked 5 in 2 innings, earning a no decision with a 15-8 loss. Nick, of course, was disappointed in his debut performance. His second start was against the Kansas City Royals, in which he earned another no decision, allowed 3 earned runs, striking out 3, and winning the game 5-3. He earned his one and only career decision on May 12, 2008 against the Chicago White Sox, giving up 4 earned runs in 5 2/3 innings, leading his team to a 10-7 victory. After that, he was sent back to the Salt Lake Bees and spent the rest of the 2008 season there with a 9-13 record and a 5.76 earned run average. And finally, Nick earned his spot on the Angels' 2009 starting roster during spring training. He appeared in 6 starts and had a 3-0 record with a 3.12 earned run average in 26 innings. He allowed 9 earned runs and 5 walks, but struck out 18. Nick began the 2009 season as a third starter in the Angels' rotation. His season debut was on April 8, 2009, and it would be the last game he would ever play. With his father in the stands looking on, Nick threw 6 scoreless innings, giving up 7 hits and escaping 2 loaded bases against the Oakland A's. Nick left the game with a 4-0 lead, but they would go on to lose 6-4. Of the game, Nick said, "I battled early and it felt good to get out of some of those jams," referring to the loaded bases. Hours later, Nick went out with 3 friends to celebrate his debut performance. 20-year-old Courtney Stewart of Diamond Bar, California, who was the driver of the car that evening, a silver Mitsubishi Eclipse, 25-year-old Henry Pearson of Manhattan Beach, California, and 24-year-old John Wilhite, also of Manhattan Beach. Courtney was a cheerleader at nearby Cal State Fullerton, and from what I could find in news articles and statements from her family, it does not seem that Courtney and Nick were romantically involved. And John was an acquaintance who played baseball at Cal State Fullerton from 2004 to 2008. And Henry Pearson was a friend of Nick's who he met while they were both attending school at Arizona State University. The 4 friends had gone dancing at a club in Fullerton when sometime after midnight they got into their car and drove away. They did not get very far, however. Just before 12:30 a.m. on the morning of April 9th, 2009, their Mitsubishi Eclipse was broadsided by a minivan that ran a red light. The impact of the van caused both vehicles to spin out, sending the Eclipse crashing into a utility pole, and the other vehicle struck another car, but that driver was uninjured. The driver of the minivan fled the crash on foot, but was apprehended 30 minutes later, and we'll get to him in a moment. Courtney and Henry were pronounced dead at the scene. John was rushed to UCI Medical Center in critical condition, as he had suffered extensive injuries and brain damage. He would survive the accident, but the injuries were severe and permanent. Nick was also rushed to UCI, but he would succumb to his injuries during surgery. He was 22 years old. The Angels postponed the game the night following Nick's debut for the team, also with the Oakland A's, which was to be the final of that season series opener. Team manager Mike Socha addressed the media at a news conference, stating it's a tragedy that won't ever be forgotten. In that Friday night series opener in Anaheim against the Boston Red Sox, the team honored Nick by wearing his number on their jerseys for the remainder of the season. Nick's dad came to the stadium later the same day his son died and walked out onto the baseball field. He lingered around the mound for a few moments, and he also had a chance to speak to the team and the team officials, and he thanked them for bringing up his son from the minor leagues all the way up into the majors. So the driver of the minivan, he was 22-year-old Andrew Thomas Gallo of Riverside, California. And he had a passenger with him, his stepbrother, Raymond Rivera. They were driving eastbound on Orangethorpe Avenue when they struck the Mitsubishi Eclipse that was being driven by Courtney as her car crossed the intersection of Lemon Street and Orangethorpe. Following the collision, bystanders witnessed a man exiting the van on the driver's side and leaving the scene of the crash. Two people came forward and indicated that they saw him talking on his phone as he walked away. One of them even heard him say to whoever he was talking to on the phone, I'm in trouble. A couple of the witnesses attempted to get him to stop, but he kept going. About a half hour later, a police officer spotted Gallo walking along the shoulder of a nearby freeway. He again attempted to flee, but the officer was able to apprehend him. Several witnesses at the scene identified him on the spot as the person they saw exiting the van through the driver's side door. His stepbrother Raymond would later say that after the crash, he vaguely remembered Gallo telling him to run, bitch. Gallo was taken into custody, and while he was being handcuffed, he asked the officer if they were okay. And I don't know if the officer answered him. Later, photographs of Gallo's body clearly showed abrasions that were caused by the seatbelt, and it was obvious that they were made on the driver's side. The intersection at which the crash occurred is controlled by traffic signals. An officer with an expertise in collision investigation was tasked with examining the intersection signals to make sure that they were functioning properly the night of the crash, which he found that they were in working order. And in his investigation, he concluded that Courtney did have the green light, while the van that Gallo was driving had the red light. An accident reconstruction expert also investigated the crash. He visited the crash scene, he inspected the vehicles involved, and he was able to retrieve data from the van and the third vehicle that was hit in the crash. He pored over witness statements and was able to make a comprehensive report of his findings. He concluded that, at the time of the collision, Courtney was driving approximately 43 miles or 69 kilometers per hour, while the van was traveling at approximately 66 miles or 106 kilometers per hour. And he also found from the event data recorder that the brakes on the van were not applied prior to colliding into the eclipse, but the throttle was let up about 1/10 of a second before the crash. And Gallo had a previous conviction for driving under the influence. And at the time of the crash, his license was suspended. On the afternoon and evening prior to the collision, Gallo and his stepbrother had been drinking at a number of establishments in West Covina. A blood sample was taken from Gallo after he was arrested, and it indicated that he had a blood alcohol content of 0.19%. A forensic expert was able to determine, based on the time of the crash and the time that his blood was drawn, that at the time of the collision, Gallo's blood alcohol content was around 0.22%, very close to 3 times the legal limit. Gallo had tried to claim that he wasn't the one driving the van, which was owned by his father and his stepmom, and they were claiming that they gave Raymond permission to drive the van, and Gallo's sister, who also lived at the home, stated that she did not see him driving the van that day when they left either. But investigators had enough evidence and witnesses to be able to solidly place Gallo in the driver's seat. During his interrogation, Gallo told police that he must have blacked out trying to find his way home and only came to when the cars collided. He said that they started drinking at a bar in Covina where his girlfriend worked as a waitress. He said that he and his stepbrother left after about an hour and a half to go pick up an Xbox gaming console from a friend of theirs. And then they went to another bar called The Well. He told police that he told his stepbrother that he needed to go home because he was starting a new job the next day, but the two of them went to the bar anyway. He said that he kept saying that he needed to stop drinking, but someone ordered them a round of shots. He claimed that he tried to avoid drinking shots of hard liquor because he just couldn't handle it, explaining that the last time he did that at a party, he blacked out there too. He said that he had no idea how he and Raymond ended up in Fullerton. He was not familiar with the area. He says he doesn't remember getting into the car or leaving from the last place that they were at, and the thing that woke him up was the impact. He said he can only guess that he was trying to drive home and blacked out, that he thinks that they were lost, and he doesn't know anyone in Fullerton. And he didn't understand why he was in the driver's seat because his license was suspended for not completing some court-ordered requirements for a DUI conviction back in 2006, for which he was still on probation at the time of the fatal crash. He said he doesn't know why he was driving, that he wasn't supposed to be driving. The following year, Gallo would go on trial, charged with 3 counts of second-degree murder. The prosecutor decided not to go for the lesser charge of manslaughter because of his previous conviction and having been warned many times about the dangers of drinking and driving under the influence. But he chose to disregard all of that. His defense attorney would claim that he is responsible for the deaths of those 3 people that night, but he is not guilty of murdering anyone, stating, quote, "He did it. He has to live with that for the rest of his life. But Andrew Gallo is not a murderer." She described him as a young, recovering alcoholic who had tried twice before to kick his addiction, having been convicted at the age of 18 for driving under the influence. But the prosecutor wasn't having any of it, reminding the jurors that Gallo had been warned several times about driving under the influence, even having his license suspended in 2006 for that exact reason, but he dismissed all of the warnings and chose to get behind the wheel that night of April 8, 2009. A night where all Gallo was concerned about was indulging himself in his drinking. She presented video surveillance footage of Gallo at the West Covina bar the night of the crash, along with his stepbrother. In the video, you can clearly see Gallo drinking one beer after another and shot after shot after shot. His defense attorney tried to tell the jurors that Gallo didn't intend to get behind the wheel that night, that he had almost always been the designated driver. But on that fateful night, it was his stepbrother Raymond who told him to drive, that they just drank too much. Gallo experienced a blackout and somehow ended up in Fullerton, a place where he doesn't know anyone. And they still, to this day, have no idea why they were there. You think it's because you were drunk and lost? Just saying. But despite all that, according to the defense, Gallo never meant to kill anyone. That what happened in that intersection was not a murder. But the jury disagreed and convicted Gallo of 3 counts of felony murder and felony drunk driving. And he was sentenced to 51 years to life in prison, the maximum sentence the judge could hand him. He would also be eligible for parole in 49 years. Incidentally, the bar that served Gallo that night lost its license to serve alcohol in the wake of what came out in the surveillance video of him being served all those beers and shots without being cut off. So I'm kind of curious as to how you all listening feel about Gallo's sentence of 51 years. We can discuss it on Facebook after this episode goes live, but there are those who feel the sentence did not fit the crime, that it was too harsh. And I read a blog post written in 2010 by Scott Greenfield entitled No Justice. You can find it at blog.simplejustice.us. and I wanted to share it with you. Nick Aidenhard's parents did not attend the sentencing. They sent a note instead, telling the judge, "There is no justice as long as Mr. Gallo is drawing breath." They are partially right. There is no such thing as justice. The Los Angeles Times article recaps a story that ended yesterday when Orange County Superior Court Judge Richard Toohey imposed a sentence of 51 years in prison on 23-year-old Andrew Thomas Gallo. He is eligible for release after 49 years. Judge Toohey gave prosecutors what they sought: consecutive sentences on the 3 second-degree murder charges and other felenies stemming from the April 2009 crash that killed Aidenhard, 22, and friends Courtney Stewart, 20, and Henry Pearson, 25. John Wilhite, 24, survived the crash but sustained major injuries. On the night Aidenhard pitched 6 scoreless innings, Gallo was out drinking with his stepbrother. And just past midnight, he barreled through a red light in Fullerton at 65 miles per hour and rammed his minivan into a vehicle carrying the 4 friends. Gallo fled on foot but was captured 2 miles from the scene. His blood alcohol content was more than twice the legal limit, more than 2 hours after the crash. Not only was he driving under the influence, he was obliterated, the judge said, noting that Gallo was on probation at the time for an earlier drunk driving conviction. "Mr. Gallo, you have devastated 4 families. Really 5 with your own." Ironically, Gallo's brother was the designated driver, except he got drunk too. Gallo made the horrible choice to drive home. Drunks make bad choices. He understood how bad of a decision it was. "You're right. I'm a horrible person. A drunk driver who took your beautiful kids away," Gallo told the judge before sentencing. "They had big, bright futures ahead of them. And because of me, they're gone." Treating a death caused by drunk driving the same as an intentional murder is all the rage, pun intended. The family of the poor, wonderful young people who died were grief-stricken. And to think that they will be comforted by Gallo's imprisonment forever, if not the forfeiture of his life. They will someday come to realize that it doesn't help. But that realization will bring them no comfort. Nothing will return the life of a child, no matter what caused the death. There is no comfort to be found. There is no justice. In the face of a room filled with nothing but agony, Gallo's lawyer, Jacqueline Goodman, stood firm. This is what she had to say. "Everyone is pretending. Pretending that Andrew isn't a good person, not an ordinary young man. Pretending that 3 sets of parents who held their babies in their arms and dreamed about their futures are any different from the parents who at that same time, 23 years ago, on those very same days, held their first baby boy, Andrew, bounced him on their knee, and dreamed of his future, full of love and promise. Pretending those innocent parents are not victims themselves. Pretending their pain is less relevant here. Pretending that the victims were not themselves human. Beautiful and yes, flawed. Pretending that Courtney Stewart's mistakes did not exist and that Andrew Gallo's mistakes were intent to kill. We are pretending that Andrew is on par with those depraved killers who look into the eyes of their victims and determine willfully to take their lives. We're pretending that 51 years to life will have an impact on whether a different young man or woman drinks and then foolishly gets behind the wheel, believing as they do in their omnipotence and their immortality. We are pretending that here today, that we are somehow not taking another life with cold intention in response to the loss of lives in a tragic accident. I will not pretend. Andrew Gallo is a good and gentle soul who never set out to harm another person and who does not deserve to lose his life. He comes from a good family, a military family, his own brother a Marine, a family who, in deference to the pain of the parents of the victims and without thought of their own sorrow, every day gave up the front seats in their son's own trial to the parents of the decedents here. They quietly sat in the back, entered and exited last, even as their son's taking was on display in slow motion. And it is absurd to think that we can summarize in a few sentences the infinite value of any of these lives or the depths of sorrow at these losses. But the only way that we might spare a life or several lives from a similar fate is to allow Andrew the opportunity to share the lessons he's learned at such a great cost. That would be a far greater and more fitting legacy to Henry Pearson, Courtney Stewart, Nick Aidenhart, and Jonathan Wilhite. That in their names was dealt mercy and temperance and understanding instead of vengeance and blame. That in their names, others were spared their own lives. This would be the most fitting tribute to these extraordinary people. They would stand for forgiveness over blame. My own father is dying. He saw me in court one time, and that was here, in closing arguments. My father is a recovering alcoholic. He had about 30 years of life-affirming sobriety, but it took him about 40 years to reach it. Fate denied Andrew as much of a chance. Today, Andrew and I know that we come into this battle to lose. The victory sometimes is in showing up. The victory is speaking truth to power. It is speaking love to hate. And at this moment, my father is dying because I am in this hearing today. I may not be by his side when he passes out of this life and into the next. But know this, that I am profoundly privileged to stand next to Andrew Gallo. And in my father's name, I proudly stand on the side of honesty, of hope and redemption over blame. As Gallo's attorney spoke these words, another man, Jeremy Cancel, was sentenced on the other side of the country for the strangulation murder of a Pace University student, Kevin Pravia. Jeremy Cancel giggled as he was sentenced. He is eligible for release in 25 years. The emotional desire to make the object of one's pain feel it as well is understandable. But Andrew Gallo was stupid, not venal. Jeremy Cancel was venal, but an ordinary, intentional murder isn't the latest focus of society's outrage, even when it's so personal as strangulation. And Jeremy Cancel's victim didn't know how to throw a baseball with great velocity. So dreamers, just to be clear, if someone is driving under the influence and that person causes a crash in which one or more people are killed, they don't automatically charge the drunk driver with murder. Here in California, it's called a Watson murder, which is a form of California's penal code for 187 second degree murder. And it gets its name from a 1981 California Supreme Court case, the People versus Watson. In the case, the court held that a DUI driver who causes a fatal accident can be convicted of a Penal Code 187 murder if that driver acted with implied malice. And this is precisely what Andrew Gallo was charged with three times over. But there are other conditions that bring a defendant's case to the level of second-degree murder. It can be charged when someone with a prior California DUI conviction kills someone while driving under the influence. But what is implied malice? Also known as malice aforethought, it doesn't require the defendant to have any ill will towards the victim or an intention to cause the victim's death. Rather, a defendant acts with implied malice when he or she intentionally commits an act, in Gallo's case, driving under the influence, and that the natural and probable consequences of the act is dangerous to human life. That at the time that the defendant acts, he or she knows that the act is dangerous and the defendant deliberately acts with conscious disregard for human life. The challenge for the prosecutor is proving that the driver acted with a conscious disregard for life. If the prosecutor in Gallo's case wasn't able to prove that, then a DUI that would result in a death would usually be charged as gross vehicular manslaughter while intoxicated, or vehicular manslaughter while intoxicated, gross being a more conscious and voluntary disregard of the need to use reasonable care, which is likely to cause foreseeable death, and is more extreme than a failure to exercise reasonable care causing a death. So in California, a prosecutor can bring a Watson murder charge when the defendant has at least one prior conviction for driving under the influence and the defendant attended a California DUI school or was read a Watson admonition in connection with the prior offense. And this is why the prosecutor repeatedly reminded the court and the jury that Gallo had been instructed and told the potential dangers of his actions at his first conviction, but chose to get behind the wheel while extremely intoxicated anyway. A Watson admonition is a warning given to every defendant in California convicted of driving under the influence. Every one of them, including Gallo at his 2006 conviction. It reads as follows. You are hereby advised that being under the influence of alcohol or drugs both impairs your ability to safely operate a motor vehicle. Therefore, it is extremely dangerous to human life to drive while under the influence of alcohol or drugs or both. If you continue to drive while under the influence of alcohol or drugs or both, and as a result of that, someone is killed, you can be charged with murder. And it was the reading of this admonition to Gallo during his 2006 sentencing that served as proof of implied malice on the part of Gallo, which won the prosecution the second-degree murder convictions, each one carrying a minimum sentence of 15 years, which the judge ordered to be served consecutively instead of concurrently, bringing the time behind bars for the murders to 45 years, and the rest of the charges he faced related to the crash tacked on another 6, and he won't be eligible for parole for 49 years. However, it is worth mentioning that neither the previous conviction nor having been given the Watson admonition is required for a prosecutor to file murder charges when a fatality is caused by a DUI if the prosecutor can prove implied malice. And malice may be implied if the conduct of the driver showed a wanton disregard for life and the facts show that the driver was especially aware of the risks his or her conduct created. For example, let's say a man is an emergency medical technician or an EMT, and on one of his nights off, he goes out drinking. And while he's driving home on the freeway, he blacks out and swerves onto the shoulder, and in doing so, he strikes another driver who is changing a flat tire and kills him. He's never had a previous DUI conviction, therefore he's never been given the Watson admonition. But by virtue of being a paramedic, it is implied that he should have known better than to get behind the wheel after a night of drinking. But by and large, a prosecutor is most likely to charge a defendant with a Watson murder when he or she had a very high blood alcohol content, usually above 0.15%, has had previous convictions for drunk and/or drug driving, or was engaged in extremely reckless driving, like driving at excessive speeds, exhibitions of speeds, or felony evading of a police officer. So I did look Gallo up. He's 31 years old now. This happened when he was 22. And from what I could see, it looks like he will be eligible for parole in April of 2028. On Gallo's inmate search page, it says that the parole eligibility date shown is the first date the inmate is or was eligible for a parole suitability hearing as a youth offender because he or she committed his or her offense while under the age of 26. The inmate's first parole hearing will be scheduled during his or her 15th, 20th, or 25th year of incarceration, depending on the sentence imposed by the court. So, as of right now, because he was a youthful offender at the time, that April 2028 date is a tentative date to have a consultation with Gallo, according to his page. In late 2012, the 4th District Court of Appeals upheld Gallo's conviction. His defense contended that the trial judge in his case was biased against Gallo, and in doing so, denied him his rights to due process and a fair trial. The defense had motioned to have the trial moved out of Orange County because of Nick's notoriety being a pitcher for the Anaheim Angels, but the judge struck down their motion to have the trial moved. The panel of 3 justices disagreed, and they found that he did receive a fair trial, and the judge was not guilty of any kind of misconduct. And then in February of 2013, the California Supreme Court denied a review of Gallo's case altogether. Henry Pearson, who was 25 years old when he was killed, was the only son of Arita and Nigel Pearson, and he was also teammates with John Wilhite. He played second base. A memorial was held for him in Manhattan Beach with more than 500 people gathering on the baseball diamond of his former high school. He spent most of his short life in Manhattan Beach, and it was a fitting tribute with mourners wearing either Dodgers, Angels, or Mets caps, the 3 teams that Henry loved. The memorial was even broken down into 9 innings, and they played the national anthem, they had a 7th inning stretch, peanuts were donated by the Dodgers organization, and Henry's best friend, Steve Hershey, was the master of ceremonies, doing so by imitating the voice of Vin Scully. Henry and Nick became friends back when Nick was rehabbing from his surgery on his elbow, and they remained close friends as Nick made his way finally onto the Angels starting roster that game on April 8, 2009. Nothing was going to keep Henry away from Angel Stadium that night to watch his friend pitch the best game of his young career. Henry loved dancing, often finding himself the life of the party. He knew a vast wealth of sports trivia even as a kid, and he had an infatuation when it came to sports, especially baseball. As Henry would put it, a clock doesn't determine the outcome of the game. You've got to play 9 innings and it's never over though. Something has to complete the game. Courtney Stewart was the only child of Carrie Stewart Dixon, and she was 20 years old when she was killed. It took 7 months for Carrie to get back to work after Courtney's death, but every day continued to be devastating. Carrie said that Courtney went to the Angels game that night to watch Nick, a friend of hers, but she wasn't planning on going out after the game because she had class the next morning, but ended up going anyway. Carrie and Courtney had this routine about their phone calls. In particular, they would talk on Tuesdays and Thursdays right before Courtney had class. The crash happened just after midnight on Thursday the 9th, and Carrie never got her morning call. A friend of Carrie's called her around 8 that morning and said that she saw Courtney's car on the news. They had already heard about Nick's death, and they knew that Courtney was with him. Carrie tried calling and texting for a couple of hours, and it wasn't until after 10 a.m. when the coroner's office contacted her with their official statement that Courtney was gone. Carrie was never going to be a grandma, and no one was ever going to call her mom again. In May of 2017, the lone survivor in that crash that killed Nick, Courtney, and Henry, John Wilhite, attended a reenactment of a fatal crash the morning after prom at Tribeca Hills High School, a little more than 8 years after the crash. 1,500 students looked on and fought back tears as firefighters using the jaws of life removed the bodies of 3 teenagers pronounced dead at the mock accident. John could not bear to watch, but once he was given the signal, the release of 3 red balloons, he stepped up to speak for the very first time at an event like this. He told the students, and he himself choking back tears, "To you guys, this seems like a bad dream, but to my family, the Pearsons, the Stewarts, and the Aidenharts, This is our reality. John doesn't remember the crash. His injuries were massive. The impact separated his spine from his skull. His lungs collapsed. He suffered numerous broken ribs, a fractured scapula, and brain shearing, which I had to look up. It's the tearing of the brain's long connective nerve fibers that happens when the brain is injured and being shifted and moved around inside the skull, usually leading to a coma and injury to different parts of the brain. And John is the very first survivor of an internal decapitation ever in Orange County. He feels extremely grateful to be alive, but had to relearn basic things like walking, talking, and eating. He goes through some bouts of stiffness, but otherwise he's physically okay. And during Angel spring training, he works as a guest coach. As anyone can imagine, being the sole survivor hasn't been easy. Often wondering if he's doing enough with the extra time that he's been given. Is he living his best life? And that's what brought him out that day to speak for the first time. To honor his friends. Even in a small way. Keeping one teenager from getting behind the wheel while intoxicated is a win for him. So what do you all think about the sentence Andrew Gallo received? 51 years to life. Does the punishment fit the crime? Should his age be taken into consideration, being only 22 at the time he slammed his minivan into that car carrying those four young people? Or do you agree with the blog post I shared with you? That nothing is going to make the loss of Courtney, Nick, and Henry or the damage done to John's life any easier, including sending Gallo to prison for this amount of time. The parents of the three victims have not minced words. They never want to see Gallo free. And the only justice that will suffice is when the time comes that Gallo is no longer drawing breath. I'm usually on the fence when it comes to stuff like this. A part of me feels like rehabilitation can help Gallo more than hard prison time. But I'm not the one who has lost a child, especially in such a senseless and violent manner. And the prosecutors usually go with the wishes of the family, who are grief-stricken and angry and wish death upon Gallo. This is a case where everyone lost. The Aidenharts, the Stewarts, the Pearsons, the Wilhites, and the Gallows as well. Thank you so much for joining me for this bonus episode of California Dreaming. Until next time, sweet dreams.